welcome to episode 16 of the Planning Period Podcast, the Ed Break Room. I'm your host, Brad Scheffler. In this week's episode, I talked to Beth Scanlon, reading, literacy, and technology coach at a nearby school to me in Central Florida, as well as one of the founders of our local EdCamp conference, EdCamp Orange. Beth and I have crossed paths a few times at different conferences and events, and every time I've spoken to her, I'm blown away by her insights into the profession. So I was really excited to talk to her for the show. This episode is also a little different because it was originally aired live and uncut on VoiceEd Radio. Beth and I went live on the air for a little over an hour, and it only aired the one time, and then I cut it up and made this episode. You might notice the flow of the conversation is just a little different than what you might be used to, and that is mostly because I was getting used to this sort of new style. This won't be the last live episode, but after this, I think I've got a better idea of how it should flow. In this episode, Beth and I discuss the teacher shortage, keeping teachers excited, and when they lose that passion they start with, the power of reading as a teacher, both professionally and personally, the power of doing things that are different as teachers, and the struggle of being a parent of a student in public school, as well as the struggle of being a child of a teacher. But for now, sit back and enjoy Planning Period Podcast, Episode 16, my interview with Beth Scanlon. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Planning Period Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Brad Scheffler. And I am talking today to Beth Scanlon, a friend of mine locally. We've met at a couple different conferences, and I thought would be a great guest to come on and talk to you guys about some of her thoughts about education. So say hi for me, Beth.
Hi, everybody.
So, Beth, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do, how long you've been teaching, that kind of stuff?
Sure. I'm about to enter my 25th year teaching at a school in Central Florida. And I work as the literacy coach. For the past 2 years, I've been helping with digital implementation, kind of following behind your footsteps, Brad, because you guys were a year ahead of us. And then working just kind of on my own pursuits with blogging and just, you know, a work in progress in terms of being a teacher. So I'm excited for the upcoming school year, all these changes.
I know. And for us, I don't know about you, I've actually been back all week getting ready for pre-planning next week. So definitely lots of work to be done.
Yes. Actually, officially I'm back. I've been working on and off all summer, but I'm officially back tomorrow.
Ah, nice. Yeah. So end of the summer is always a mixed bag for me. It's like, I'm glad I'm going back to a schedule again, have a reason to get out of bed, if you will. I'm excited for that part of it, but I don't know that I necessarily actually want to go back to work. I'm always torn on that.
I get that. I just know there's always so much work to do, and you know, whether I'm there or not, the work's still going to be there. So, you know, I guess I'm ready. I just make sure I take a really clean break from the work. With no technology.
I don't ever go with no technology. That is never a reality of my life. I don't ever go more than a couple inches from technology for the most part. But I do try to get away from work a little bit, by which I mean I still check my email multiple times a day the entire summer and also answer things and am constantly involved in the education sphere. So no, I don't take any kind of break at all. That's a lie. I don't take any kind of break whatsoever. So maybe I should. Maybe I'd appreciate that.
You should try it maybe for 24 hours. I do a week in the woods where there's no technology. So
that sounds nice. I was actually listening to a different podcast today. I'll shout them out. Very Bad Wizards is an excellent podcast about just philosophy and psychology and just deeper thought. Not necessarily education, but deeper thought. It's fascinating to me. And they were interviewing a guy who wrote a book about Buddhism, and he talked about going to these week-long silent retreats. And something about spending a week around a bunch of people and none of us are talking sounds simultaneously terrifying and fascinating. Like, I don't know if I could make it, but I want to try.
Yeah, that I've read a little bit about that, and it seems a little extreme, because I like to talk, but I could see where You know, I believe what I've been doing is forest bathing before it's become like a thing. So
I like that. I can go with that.
Yes. So apparently, you know, forest bathing is good for the, you know, mind, the soul, et cetera, out of a Japanese, you know, culture tradition. And so I'm glad I've been doing something good like that, but being quiet for a week.
I think it's because I like to talk so much. I think that's why I'm so fascinated by it is like, I do this podcast, I do presentations and I teach and I run night classes and I'm kind of all over the place and I really just love to tell stories and I'm curious where my mind would go if I didn't have that escape. I think that's probably what fascinates me the most about the idea or intrigues me, if you will.
Yeah, I just know I have trouble just meditating for 5 minutes, so, you know.
Yeah, maybe I should start small, because I've never actually tried to meditate, so maybe I should just start with that, instead of jumping straight into a week-long retreat.
Yeah, small steps.
Yeah. All right, well, you know, Beth, I mentioned I'm excited to have you on. You know, we have a lot of mutual friends, actually, and listeners of the podcast will know the first time we met was at ESET, two a couple years ago, and my second guest on the podcast ever was Kristen Iannuzzi, who you know as well.
Yes.
And she is amazing and exciting, and I loved talking with her, but, you know, we talked about ESET, and as soon as her and I started talking about ESET, I was like, you know, I need to reach out to Beth, and then, you know, it got busy, and life happens, and I forgot, and then I was working on that EdCamp stuff, and I was like, ooh, Beth is the person to talk to. Beth is the EdCamp person I can think of off the top of my head, so I was very excited to reach out to you and come up with another excuse to do so. So I'm excited about that. But I do want to mention you are in charge of EdCamp, right? You run the EdCamp in our Central Florida area.
Correct. I'm one of the three co-founders of EdCamp Orange. Alina Davis is one of my peers who we co-founded this together, as well as Leanne Spillane. And we actually met at an ed camp. And so that's kind of where we got the, what I like to call edspiration, to bring an ed camp here. So it's been the brain work of three people together. And so,
cool. I'm determined to make it this year to ed camp. And I really want to get a chance to get out there because I have not made it yet to one of yours. And I really, really want to. We did the mini ed camp at ESET this past year. It was like a little mini version, I felt like. And that was really cool. But I really want to get to like a true ed camp. And I'm excited to hopefully make it out to your guys this year.
Well, our ed camp is one of the first in 2018. But the ed camp that kind of got my, you know, that spurred my kind of ed camp desire was ed camp Citrus, which is in September. And I'll be heading to that if you want to join me.
I'm putting it right now, like note to self to look it up because that would be a great idea. I want to go. I'm going to have to find a way to make that happen. So absolutely. And actually, I'm running on a little bit of advance. So that's probably around the time this episode will actually go out on the podcast. So if you're not hearing this live, that's probably around the time you're hearing this. So that'll be perfect.
Cool. Yeah, that is the Ed Camp Citrus was the very first Ed Camp in the state of Florida. I think it's in its sixth or seventh year. And so it was a really great model for me about and for us on how we could bring it back here. So it's cool. Really, really well done.
That's awesome. I'm excited. So, all right. Well, Beth, I do want to get into my first real question of the podcast. You know, we've been going for a little bit here, but I want to get into my first real question. And my first question for you is, what is currently the biggest problem facing education?
You know, I would say my biggest current problem is really this teacher shortage. You know, which has been manufactured, created, self-fulfilling prophecy or something, you know, manufactured by forces are seemingly sometimes beyond an individual teacher's control. So I would say that's been kind of that's my most disheartening problem, especially as we begin a new school year, that's just been a real struggle for many, you know, there are many, many forces that are pushing on teachers, young teachers, or people who want to think about becoming a teacher. And that's my real personal kind of pain.
Do you find that the shortage is more about is it more about people leaving this profession, like coming in and not staying, or is it more about not getting people in at all?
I think it's all of the above. I know nationwide, they're saying that enrollment in colleges of education are down about 42%. And I can't actually cite where I got that from. But I believe that was a feature in the Tampa Bay Times a few weeks ago when they were talking about the enrollment at USF being down about 27%. So
now, to be fair, that could be because people don't want to go to USF because they're geographically confused. That is a university in Central Florida that for some reason thinks it's in South Florida. As a diehard UCF Knight fan, I cannot miss a chance to insult USF. So just throwing that out there.
I like it. But the nationwide figure is kind of troubling for me.
That I care more about.
But, you know, so I think that's part of it. And then it's the staying, you know, the teacher morale. I think it's the problem of both. And in my job, I get to work with new teachers. So I feel like from a one-to-one piece and as a teaching community, I can do work to kind of stave that off. But part of it is I've got to get you there first. And I know that colleges of education are not the only paths for people to become teachers. It's just what makes this job desirable. You know, I've taught in the College of Education at a local university here. And, you know, I've taught that and I've had classes as large as 50 students, 25 students, all who want to be English teachers. And the people who want to go in this profession are excited, and so what do we do to keep them excited when they hit the wall? So that's...
That's an interesting way to look at it. And I haven't thought about it that way. They go into that field excited. They go into the college excited to do this career, and yet I wonder if you did some sort of study on the excitement level of going into college versus the excitement level of going into their first day of teaching versus the excitement level of going into the first day in year two. I wonder if we could genuinely track a downturn or some sort of something there, or find that point where it changes. I'm wondering what that point is for those teachers.
Yeah, and I think that's a great question, and I think you could track it. You could definitely find a population to track it. You know, I think initially some are really turned out in their internship, and that's sometimes a good time to let go, I guess, but, you know, you've only had one experience. And I would also say, you know, perhaps not all schools are good fits for teachers too, so I think you could track it, and it might be interesting to look at that in terms of teacher retention, you know, to take a cohort through and kind of track.
Yeah, I would. That'd be an interesting research to do. Now I'm like trying to think about ways I could actually pull that off. You mentioned talking about internship, and it kind of speaks to something I think about. And I'm sure you've experienced this as well. An intern comes on campus, or just a classroom observer that wants to be a teacher or whatever. You're talking to somebody at a party and, you know, someone says to you, "Hey, I want to be a teacher." I think there's a knee-jerk reaction, even among teachers, to say, "But why?" And I wonder if that's maybe, certainly not the only cause of the problem, but I wonder if maybe we're contributing to the problem by giving it this negative stigma to people that are excited about it.
I think so. I mean, part of my like personal paradigm is, you know, as I work with new teachers, I have to genuinely believe in the work. And so I never find myself kind of, you know, dissuading people from becoming teachers, because I do think it's some of the best work you can do in the world. But I have seen what you're talking about, where I do remember people saying to me, well, why do you want to be a teacher? Teachers themselves, you know, downing their own profession. So that could be a part of it, you know.
Yeah,
where
I just, you know, it's hard because I do feel like I am so passionate about this field and this career and this process. And what I find interesting is I don't know that I think I have a stronger passion now going into my eighth or ninth year, whatever it may be, than I did even in my first year of education. But I also feel like I am a genuine exception in that way. I don't feel like that's what most people feel like. I don't feel that I look at veteran teachers or teachers going into their ninth, 10th year, or look teachers are going into their 15th, and I feel like they're not as excited, or I have a hard time picturing the young kid that they were on their first day of teaching. And I wonder if this profession by nature just drives us down, or if there really is a controllable problem that we can solve to fix that.
I actually like what you brought up. You know, one of my challenges is to kind of keep work with new teachers, but keep my veteran teachers invigorated about the work. And I think about, like what you just said, what were you like your first day of teaching, your first year of teaching? And I think that's a good, question to ask during pre-planning, actually. But I don't know.
I'm wondering now if I'm just, I might just do that as an icebreaker with my staff on Monday morning of pre-planning and just say, all right, guys, this is our icebreaker. You're going to think back and you're just going to do a quick write or a quick call out of what you were on your first day of teaching. What do you remember? What were you like? Because I think maybe that's a good question we should ask some veteran teachers to really think back to what brought them here. And maybe that's, as cheesy as that sounds, but what's their why? Why are they here? And I wonder how many of them are still in touch with that.
Yeah. Why did you come back this year? You know, beyond having healthcare, or beyond having your salary, or just hanging in, you know, what's your why? Why did you get up? And I know, my friend is, she started a new job in Singapore, and they literally spent the first morning of their pre-planning telling their why story, how they got to this point in their teaching career. And that was pretty powerful. So I think you're onto something with that question.
Yeah. Maybe I need to think about that. Maybe if I ever run out of guests on the podcast, I'll just start asking that as my new question on the podcast for repeat guests. And that's how I'll keep this show alive no matter what happens. All right. Well, I'm going to go ahead and ask my second question because I'm curious, and it may actually line up with what I wanted to follow up with. So my second question is, what is something you're doing that you wish all teachers would do?
Well, it's a 4-letter word, and it starts with an R, and it's okay for me to say on your show. So I just really wish that all teachers, regardless of their subject area, would read.
Okay.
And I'm not talking about professional reading. I'm talking about any kind of reading.
So with their students specifically, or just as their own benefit?
All of the above.
Okay.
I feel like, you know, we are the most powerful role models, and I feel like we all should be reading, and just not drips from social media, but to really engage in a practice that will feed our teaching, will feed our students, and will really feed ourselves. That's something I've seen less and less of in my 25 years of teaching. So I've kind of seen a decline in that.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny. You're right in the sense that it's funny that we know how critical that is for our students. We know the critical importance of reading. And yet I feel like the emphasis on that has gone down. And maybe it was just my transition from middle school to high school, because in middle school, I definitely forced silent sustained reading and nightly reading, and that was about all they did in my class was read, it seemed like, versus high school, where it was a lot more of analyzing smaller pieces. So I don't know if that's a middle school to high school transition or unique to me, but you're right. I don't see a lot of reading taking place for pleasure among teachers, it feels like, a lot of times. I don't think there's the excitement in books that maybe I used to feel there was. Well, you think that's fair?
Yeah, and even, I mean, I think it's part of the work. Sometimes easier to check out in other ways. You know, we have so many things accessible at our fingertips, and so I think it's hard.
Do you think it's a reaction in it, it's less of an educational problem and more of a problem with the reality we live in?
I don't know. I think it could be both. You know, I'm in a community of educators who read. Some of them are, you know, science teachers. So I'm in a book club of educators that we've been meeting for 10 years. And we're just not English teachers. And so, you know, the science teachers have brought books to me I would have never picked up. And that's kind of kept me sharp. But I think it could be a societal issue, but it's also like a personal commitment about, you know, what we really value, we make time for.
Well, and I think you also mentioned, you know, it's critical if we want our students to do it, we need to model it. You know, that modeling is so critical to showing our students how important it is.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm curious though. So, cause this is something, and this maybe isn't directly related to your response, but this is something that I've been struggling with or thinking about, not struggling, I shouldn't say, but thinking a lot about recently. And I agree with you that reading social media posts, you know, scrolling through Facebook is definitely not reading in any sort of valuable kind of way. However, I'm curious about what is it about the act of reading that is so powerful to you? Is it the consumption of information or is it the physical act of reading? And I mean that in the sense of, is listening to, say, an audiobook as relevant or as powerful to you as actually reading words on a page or a Kindle or whatever else?
In terms of a physical act, I really endorse what you're talking about. I call it reading with your ears. For me, you know, reading is all of that. So it's reading kind of for that affective, for yourself, for escape, to kind of become a changed self, but it's also reading nonfiction. And I'm a literature person by nature. I come to nonfiction kind of by arm twist, but I do love listening to books in my car. I like reading on a Kindle. And honestly, I do like scrolling through my Facebook post. I love reading on my feeds in Twitter where, you know, articles are being shuttled to me, you know, greater than 140 characters. So I just find like I would like to see some longer kind of sustained reading. Even digitally is fine for me. It's not the medium or so, it's more so the act.
Okay. I like that. Now, do you think that another reason for this, cause I am, you know, obviously reading is absolutely critical, but there's also a big push right now with our teachers and our students to really have them doing the creative act. You know, I think the long-term benefits that they're going to have to society through the creation process are probably most important thing they're going to learn, you know, publishing and creating and getting your voice out there and whatever method you're creating in are going to be critical for our students. Do you think that by nature, encouraging that creation limits the time or is there some other way I should be looking at that connection?
I think like reading feeds the creation, you know, in terms of looking at models or exemplar text. I mean, I'm just thinking what I've taught myself in terms of creating, I've really become interested in infographics and I really like that construction and I like how you can take, you can synthesize lots of information you've read and really present it in a visible, viable way. So that's something I've been teaching myself. And even in terms of, you know, one of my personal passions is, blogging and teaching students how to blog. And so I know you need to do a lot of reading before you can, well, not before, while you're writing, because that reading feeds the writing. And so just like, I guess, any kind of creation, you need to like study the models. So I don't know if I answered your question.
No, I think you did. I think you did. I think the way to look at it, kind of what you're saying, is if you don't know what's out there, you can't start creating from scratch, more or less. You know, you can't just start writing having never read anything, because you don't know what writing even needs to look like. And I would argue you probably can't just start a podcast without listening to some podcasts first, or start, you know, whatever that may be, a YouTube channel, without ever watching a YouTube video. I think a lot of those things, you know, whatever that creation looks like, you need to sort of study the existing creations to get that model. So I agree. I think you're on the right track there.
And I think, you know, I also think you can have an interdisciplinary approach. I mean, I just think about studying painting and even any kind of medium that we read, because I define text pretty broadly. But my larger issue is I see a lot more regurgitation in school versus creation. And that's probably another larger issue I have.
As soon as you said that, I'm like writing notes, questions I want to ask, trying to put some stuff down here. So I agree with you completely. I think there's a huge issue with that. And I might even take it a step farther. And I say, in a lot of cases, we should never ask our students a question, especially not on a test, that they could Google the answer to. And so much of what I think back on and what I learned in high school and middle school when I was a student honestly has had no usefulness in my life, because now I have access to all of the world's information at a click. And I wonder if you would go so far as that, or maybe if you want to take a step before that, or where you feel like you're at with that.
I guess how I feel, like, especially when people complain about kids cheating or being able to Google, my question to them is, what are you asking students to do? What makes it so easy for them to do that? And I think you hit the nail on the head that many of the things we're asking kids to do, they can just Google it. They don't need to have this repository of information stored in their head, because it's at their fingertips. So
yeah. And you know,
we're on the same page.
Yeah. I think one of my favorite examples of that is, you know, and I think I'm certainly not the first person to ever say this, but I've never been a good math student. I always got good grades and I tried, but calculation and actually doing the math was never my strength. As long as I had a calculator, I was fine. I understood the theory, but the calculations I just couldn't do in my head. And, I remember teachers constantly saying things like, well, you're going to have to figure out how to do it in your head, because you're not going to walk around with a calculator in your pocket all the time. And every time I pick up my phone, I just think to myself a little bit like, ha, joke's on you, because yes, I do. Like, you know, and it's a funny example, but I also think it is representative of a bigger issue. The reality of what we teach, it is changed by technology. There's no need for me to know long division off the top of my head. There's very rare cases where that's actually useful, because the time it takes me to calculate it, I can just pull out my phone and be done way quicker. So do we need to teach the theory? Absolutely. Do they need to understand what division is? Certainly. But do we need to give them 5, 10, 15, 20 long division problems until they can do it off the top of their head? Is that something we still need to do with students? And if that's just a math example, where else can we be looking at changing the way we think about what knowledge is?
And, you know, you're getting into a spot, like, in terms of mathematical fluency, I don't feel comfortable speaking about.
Oh, trust me. I have no knowledge in this subject. I'm like ignorantly attacking something I'm completely unaware of. I agree with you completely.
And I love math, and I can do all that. Actually, I used to, do taxes and accounting. So I can do the math, you know, and I don't really have a good academic argument. I just know in my head, I have a nimbleness of numbers. And how does that help me in my daily work? But in terms of teaching, I watch kids struggle in math, and that's, I think that's a whole nother podcast segment for you, actually.
Yeah, no, I could, math person. I need to get some more math. I don't know that I've even interviewed any math people. That is a flaw in my guest list, I think. I think I need to work on my math repertoire here. I don't know. I feel like I would scare a math person off pretty quickly by calling math dumb in the first 30 seconds, and then they'd be done with me. So I don't know. I'd have to maybe be careful about finding the right math person to interview.
The right math person wouldn't be scared off by dumb. So
that's true. That's true.
But so, like, when I think about social studies in particular, like, that's, you know, that's really reading dense. But do we need to have dates? I don't know. You know, and in science,
yeah, absolutely,
there's a whole gatekeeper in terms of the academic vocabulary. And so I don't know,
so much of that has changed.
Important for kids to know off the top of their head.
Yeah. And I think the key there is that you don't know, but I don't know that anybody knows what's important for them to know off the top of their head. I don't think there's an answer to that question yet. And unfortunately, it's kind of like attacking that moving target. We don't yet know what will we need to know in the future. You know, when you talk about the power of wearables and having access to all information with a thought, or who knows what technology looks like in the future, to say whether any of this is necessary knowledge by the time these kids get out of high school, get out of college, go into the real world. So yeah, it's hard to say. And I don't know. I guess we just need to keep thinking about the question, at least. I don't know that we have an answer for it.
Right. Yeah. You know, for me, it's that kind of nimbleness of your mind and kind of that tenacity when you're struggling not to quit. You know, how do we teach those skills with kids versus, so it's easier to measure, I suppose, that stuff we can count versus.
And certainly, you know, I know this isn't what you meant, but obviously we shouldn't be teaching for what's easier to measure. I think we need to, you know, so we shouldn't fall back on that. And again, I know that's not what you meant at all, but that's definitely not what we should be falling back on as well. Those are the things we should teach, but I don't know how we measure them. So let's just teach something different.
I know. And that's exactly, I didn't mean that at all. Cause I'm just thinking, like, you know, you were talking earlier about creation, and part of that, you know, creation process with kids in terms of technology is really, you know, stumbling through, playing, messing up, and just working at it till you figure it out. And so I think that's what's really powerful about that creation process, where you are working on those. I don't know that they're soft skills. I call them life skills, where you've got to put it all together. So to create, you've got to be able to read all those layers.
Well, and I mean, we really need to be talking about doing, you know, performance-based assessment. I mean, at that point, what I feel like we're talking about is performance-based assessment over written, standardized testing, multiple-choice testing, because we need to be measuring the cross-curricular, the way they put the pieces together, all the different parts, not just the way they answer a multiple-choice question. And you can't cheat on a performance assessment. You can't Google a performance assessment. You have to actually do it, you know, and that's the solution to me for all these problems.
I definitely agree with you. I would like to see more of that. I think all of these multiple choice tests have really narrowed, you know, what's of what people teach. And they've become so concerned about the what's, they don't, you know, engage kids in the whys, the hows, or just the messiness of it. So I do love performance-based assessments.
I'm right there with you. I like it. Well, I want to move into my third question, and you were present for where this question came from, actually, and I'm curious if you know where this came from. So my third question is, who is the greatest teacher you ever had?
Oh, yes, ESET.
Yep, this came from Kristen Iannuzzi, absolutely.
And I love that question that she poses.
Yep.
I don't know. I could name a great teacher I had every single year of my K through 12 life. And I don't think a lot of kids could say that. So it's really, really hard for me to narrow that down.
I agree. I've had lots of guests have a hard time picking a favorite. I don't know that anybody said they could say every teacher they had, or at least one every year, was great.
I mean, literally, I could go through and name, and I've actually done this before on my blog, where I've named my first grade teacher, why was she great? And I literally had that experience K through 12. Probably, I mean, if I had to narrow it down K through 12, I would probably say Miss Landry. And she was my, I went to a school where the teachers taught multiple grade levels and multiple subjects, but I had Miss Landry for government. I had her for world history, and I might have had her for 3 years, but that was the first teacher who actually had, in my experience, had the students actually teach the content to each other. I'd say that would be in the 80s. And then she also had a project that we did and it was real life, where we had to research two countries, build a tour for them, do the history, all those pieces. And I remember people coming back to get those projects from her to actually take those tours later in life.
Hmm.
And so she was probably my most demanding teacher, but she did things a lot differently than a lot of other teachers I had at the time. And so
it's interesting that you're in this position where you're involved with ed camps and trying to push the discussions with teachers and push the boundaries of what we're doing and trying to push for innovative ideas and change. And when you reluctantly give me a favorite teacher, one of the things that you know about that teacher is her ability to do things differently than other teachers. You know, it's always interesting to me the connections that you can draw between a teacher's favorite teacher and how they are today. And that's what stuck out to me right there, is that connection between how she was different and how you're trying to push that different mentality to your staff now.
Thank you. She just was one in just a line of great teachers I had, because, you know, if we're doing this live and any of my family hears this, you know, my aunt was my fourth grade teacher, so I have to shout that out as well.
Obviously, but that would have been a cop out if you'd picked her. I'm glad you didn't. I'm not going to lie. I'm sure your aunt was phenomenal, but.
She was. But I did have to say that. I'm contemplating where I send my daughter, you know, in high school, and I've had these friends who've taught their own kids, so. Mm-hmm. You know, that is, I survive family teaching me, so maybe my kid will.
You know, I struggle with that myself. My son is 5. He'll be starting kindergarten in 2 weeks, 13 days, not that I'm counting and terrified of it. he is starting kindergarten, and I am terrified. I am really terrified. I don't know how well I'm going to handle the, I'm a teacher, you're a teacher, I don't necessarily agree with what you just did as an instructional practice. Like, I don't know how to balance those as a parent. I don't have the solution yet. And I've asked a lot of my guests, so I'll be glad to ask you as well. How did you as a parent balance that line?
I can tell you that I always called, like, open house or meet the teacher. I always called meet the teacher, interrogate the teacher. Because, you know, one of the things I'm famous for is asking questions. And so would ask a lot of questions. And then the things that I really valued, I really, you know, I didn't fight every battle, but one of my, especially in elementary school, my daughter's school had AR, and that was a battle that I just set my boundary. I knew I didn't want my kid to feel different in not doing it. My kid was a reader, but I would always let the teacher know why. I would give them research, and, you know, we would find a middle ground, because ultimately, you know, the teachers are doing the best they can. But, you know, sometimes there are expectations in the system that you have to decide, is this where I want to put my flag in the ground? Because the other thing with being a TK, as my daughter says, you know, you already feel different. Because your mom knows, all the things you're supposed to be doing.
Well, I can tell you, my dad is listening right now, and he is, as of a month ago, a retired elementary school principal who was also a high school band director and one of my teachers when I was in elementary school. So I definitely understand the, you already feel different. For sure, I get that. I get that part of it. It's like, as a teacher's kid, you have this realization, I feel like our students don't think that we're human beings. They don't realize, even high schoolers, I feel like, don't necessarily realize that you exist outside of the school. They think you are just this entity that survives in this one space, and outside of that, you don't do anything except for go home and grade their work, and then you come back to school and teach them again. So anytime I see a student outside of school, there's always that moment where they're like, Mr. Schreffler? You grocery shop? Yeah, I grocery shop. I have to eat as well. I also eat food. That is a thing. And they're always like, wow. And I think, to me, the fundamental difference of being a TK, as your doctor, a teacher's kid, as your daughter would say, is that you realized for your entire life that teachers are human beings, and your friends don't always get that. And I think that's maybe one of the ways that she feels different. But I agree. You know, and like you said, I guess you got to pick your battles. It's so hard. I just don't ever want to be that teacher or that, I don't ever want to be that parent that I have dealt with where they think they're a better teacher than me. And so they kind of talk down to me or have their own opinions or don't agree with how I'm doing things in my class. And of course, they don't know the realities of what's going on in the full scope of my room. They know what's going on with their one kid off of the version of the story they're telling them. And I don't ever want to be that. But I also totally understand how come those parents acted like that.
Right. Yeah. I think, you know, self-awareness is the first key to survival. But, I don't know. I mean, I also think on the other side, the most intimidating things I ever had to do as a teacher was teach other teachers' kids. So I know there's, you know, on the teacher side, knowing that you're a teacher, we take extra care with those kids.
Yeah, you kind of have to.
Because we know those parents are hyper-watching us.
Yeah. You know, you said something I'm interested in, and I want to just ask about it. We've got a little bit more time here. You talked about AR, and that's one of the places you planted your flag. What is so for anybody that doesn't know, AR is Accelerated Reader. I'm sure most of my listeners know that one, but where they read books and get points depending on difficulty level and length of book and et cetera, and they take little quizzes to ensure they actually read them. What is your beef with AR, as it were? What is wrong with that system? I'm not up to date on that literature. We don't do it in high school, so.
Well, AR is where kids read in their level. And really what I know about reading is that kids can read beyond their level, especially in a topic they're an expert in. And so what I find with AR is that it can be really limiting. And what I found even with my own child, because she was excited to do AR. She was one of the kindergartners who was picked to do AR early. And I didn't want to kibosh that. But we were doing a lot of reading at home, and that reading necessarily wasn't tested. And so your really great readers had really huge goals. And I never wanted the goal of AR to get in the way of my kids' reading mileage. And so for some students, reading for extrinsic rewards and points, if that's what gets them to reading, it works. But for my own reader and my own beliefs about reading, I never wanted my kid to take a test over every single book she read to get points. And I really didn't want her reading limited by what the school had in terms of tests and what books. You know, the world of reading is so wide and wonderful. I never wanted my kid limited. So, but that was something I was able to negotiate with the teacher in terms of keeping her goal small and, you know, having the teacher recognize my kid is reading and she's just not going to read in her level kind of thing. She's going to read all over
the place. It's so funny because I like when you said like AR is bad, and in middle school we used it and I liked it. I pushed my kids to read. And as soon as you said the word limiting, I had this vivid memory of being in fifth grade and told I couldn't read. I remember being in the library and there were stickers on the books of different colors, and the color represented your Lexile level, I realize now. And I was told like I couldn't read a certain book because it wasn't in my level. And I was like, but I really want to read this book. And I couldn't because I was beyond that level or below that level, whatever the case may have been. And so like I genuinely was like, what's wrong with AR? AR is not bad. And then you go limiting and I go, oh yeah, no, AR is terrible. Now it makes total sense. Like I realize in this like vivid memory come flashing to me. So that actually makes total sense now that you're saying that.
Yeah. And that just for some readers, it's ideal because perhaps it pushes them, it motivates them, but it's, you know, it's not this one size fits all. And I think that's the piece I'm more where people put these boundaries on kids based on data. It's really just not what they are. It's really anything in my kind of book because we've got really, really kind of individual needs in kids. And we've got to be careful where we like put blanket expectations on kids. So AR is just one of those places for me in my daughter's history.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, like I said, I hadn't thought about it that way, but that is such a cool way to put it. So we're live. I know my dad is listening. He's already texted me like 15 times, during this, and it's totally fine. Don't stop texting me, Dad. It's fine. I know that means I know I'm still on the air, which I was not last time. He texted me the first time saying that he loved the idea about asking, talking to your teachers about the first day of when they were a teacher. And if he were pre-planning, he would be doing that, but he's not. Which is, again, he just loves to point out that he's retired every 5 seconds. And then he said, thanks for the shout out when I was talking about him. But he did just text me and agree with you. He was an elementary school principal and he said he completely, he says, your guest is right on about AR, by the way. Plus the tests are very low level, mainly just recall. And from a principal standpoint, very expensive. So,
oh, wow.
An AR system's crazy expensive. So he's in complete agreement with you. He's letting me know that. So.
Okay. Shoo. I hate to be in trouble with a principal.
Yeah. Well, he's a former principal. You don't have to care anymore. It doesn't count. It's not.
Still, he did have that in his title. So it makes me a little nervous.
So. Yeah, and that's just a level of the professionalism that we have here on the Planning Period podcast as I read text messages from my father. So, you know, that's how we roll on Planning Period podcast live. Is it still a podcast if it's live?
Well, that's what I was wondering. Like when I asked that question earlier, like what is this medium? You said it's radio. So.
Yeah, I guess, but my show is Planning Period podcast. So. I don't know if now that's part of the proper noun of the title and taking away the noun from its purpose. I don't know. I'm not sure. I haven't decided yet. I just would be Planning Period live for today. I guess we could do that. So
okay, I like that.
We'll work with that. Planning Period live. I like it. So, you know, actually, Beth, we're running down right to the end here. We've got our schedule ran us until 8:30 on the Voice Ed Radio Network. You know, I do want to say thank you. I appreciate you taking the time to sit with me. I really do.
Well, I'm just excited to just explore this medium with you because, you know, they do have like radio shows for teens. And so I'm interested in like, how could this work with reading, writing, and publishing in terms of that creator process? So
if you are looking to do this with your students, one of the things I would point you to, and anybody listening, there's a website called ListenWise. So it's just the word listen, the word wise, WISE, listenwise.com. And they take a ton of different podcasts and add activities and assignments for teachers to do with their kids off of those podcasts. So you don't have to build all that stuff from scratch. They use a lot of NPR stuff and Radio Lab and that kind of stuff that's popular podcasts. But they have free materials as well as paid materials at listenwise.com. Not that they're not supporting us in any way, but they are a good resource if you're wanting to start doing some podcasts with your kids. They're a great place to start.
Excellent. Excellent. Because I know some of my teacher friends have done stuff with This I Believe with NPR and some stuff with StoryCorps. So
yeah.
I'm going to check that out. You've given me a list of things to do. You've given me some podcasts to listen to and some some other things to do in my last few days of vacation.
Well, I'm glad I can fill up all your spare time. I did that for you at least. So
yes,
you know, tell me a little bit about Ed Camp Orange.
Can I tell you when Ed Camp Orange is?
Please do. I would love
we
to know
because
I have to write it down. Excellent.
It's going to be January 20th.
January 20th. I'm going to put it in my calendar right now because I will be there. Any listeners who want to join us at Ed Camp Orange in Central Florida, where are you hosting it this year?
It will still be at Cypress Creek High School, but we're also looking to expand the leadership team. So if there are people who are interested in joining us in the planning, promoting, it's a great way to start to just kind of grow yourself in terms of, you know, being a professional learning leader. Please reach out to us and we're happy to have you come aboard too. So that's another aspect. We don't want to be this kind of small group. We want to kind of build our capacity.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I can tell you it is in my calendar and I will be there on January 20th.
Thanks again to Beth for being on the show and for doing it live, no less. That was a really interesting and fun experience. If you'd like to connect with Beth, check out her Twitter. She's at Scanloe, S-C-A-N-L-O-E, or her website, seeking6.blogspot.com. Also, if you're in the Central Florida area, don't forget to check out Ed Camp Orange on Twitter. They're at Ed Camp Orange or their Facebook page. As always, if you like what you've heard, do me a favor and give me a review on iTunes. It is the best way you can help out the show. Head over to tinyurl.com/planningperiodreview and you're right where you need to be. You can also connect with me on Twitter. I'm at Brad Shuffler. I always love to hear from you guys. And if you're interested in being a guest on the show, that's a great way to reach out as well. As a reminder, last week I announced that I have started a store with some planning period gear. You can check out bradshuffler.com/store where I have shirts, mugs, stickers, and more. Until next week, be sure to pick carefully where you plant your flag. Music for this podcast is provided by Kevin MacLeod and is the song Vicious, licensed under Creative Commons. This show is also a proud member of the VoiceEd Radio Network, a 24-hour radio network all about education all the time. Your voice belongs here.